Mr. Chairman, if I could have a minute before the Finance Committee starts, I would move that the board certify to the best of each member's knowledge and with no individual member dissenting that at today's just concluded board executive session, i.e. June 11, 2015, and at the board executive session of May 28, 2015, only such matters as are authorized for discussion in executive session under board bylaws Article 10, and only those matters identified in the notice by which the executive sessions were convened, were heard, discussed, or considered by the board. Now, I offer that in the form of a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the certification is provided. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Second.
That this change does not disproportionately affect our minority and low-income riders. Next is an action for the committee to amend the FY 2016 to 2021 Capital Improvement Program to allow for the purchase of an additional 227,000 series rail cars. With the Federal Transit Administration's concurrence, Metro is now able to retire its older, less reliable 5,000 series rail cars and replace them with 7,000 series rail cars to improve both safety and reliability for our customers. Finally, in its oversight role, the committee will be updated on Metro's financial status, specifically progress in addressing the FTA's financial management oversight findings. I want to commend our finance staff who have worked tirelessly over the past 14 months to ensure that all of the FTA's corrective action plan items will be addressed by the June 30th deadline set by the FTA. I would like to ask Deputy General Manager for Operations, Rob Troop, to provide the committee and the public with some important safety updates.
Chair Evans, thank you, and good afternoon, good morning, excuse me. I appreciate the opportunity to discuss passenger safety issues, the recent unintended door openings on 4,000 series cars, and also the NTSB recommendation concerning application of a weathertight seal on the cable junction booths. Let me first focus on the 4,000 series car, of which we operate 100 to our customers on all rail lines. On May 31st and June 4th, we had two separate door openings on 4,000 series cars, 4057 and 4065, respectively, on two different train consists. On June 4th, a red line train that included car 4065 experienced a malfunction of a door pushback spring, which broke as a result of metal fatigue. The spring holds the door in place and locked. And initially, the car received the all doors closed signal, which allowed the train to move. As the train began to move, the spring broke, releasing the door and causing the door open indication to relay to open. All safety circuits were in place, and the car did brake automatically and come to a complete stop as designed for safety. This safety circuitry is in place also to ensure that a train cannot leave the platform if the doors are still open. Again, on this particular incident, the safety circuitry worked as intended, and the operator received appropriate indications, and the train acted in accordance with the design. In this instance, the operator followed standard procedure and inspected the door, initiated the door lock procedure, put the train in door bypass, and successfully moved the train to the platform, where it was offloaded and returned to the yard for inspection by vehicle engineering and safety. The May 31st incident was on car 4057 and involved a broken door bypass switch. This switch is in place to allow the train to move as described above, just described. In this instance, there were two simultaneous failures which caused what we determined to be a wrong side failure, which is where the fail-safe circuitry does not reduce an operational system to its most restrictive state. In this instance, what should have occurred is that the train sees the doors open while the train is moving, and it automatically comes to a safe and complete stop. This did not happen. While the train was moving, the door opened in car 4057 and was reported by a passenger to the operator. However, the indication in the cab of the train showed an all doors closed light. The operator contacted our rail operations control center and was told to move the train under normal operating condition as the all doors closed light was indicating the train was safe to move and the train was operating in a manner that would be consistent with allowing normal operations. The failures here are numerous and our preliminary investigation has revealed. Component failure of the bypass switch represented a false indication to the operator and prevented the actuation of the fail-safe circuitry to safely disable movement of the train. Worn component that prevented the door from becoming locked, allowing the door to move under the train's inertia. Failure of the operator to properly assess the situation and operate according to procedure. Failure of the controller, or rail traffic controller, to properly instruct the operator in accordance with standard procedure. System safety engineering recognizes a high degree of reliability and very low failure rates of components to a wrong side failure, generally less than 0.0009% of a potential for a failure rate is introduced into a highly reliable system like this, a life safety system like this. System safety engineering also recognizes that systems, while highly reliable, cannot achieve a 0% chance of no wrong side failure, which is why procedures are so important and are put in place to ensure that any failure is recognized and controlled appropriately. In this instance, we had a mechanical failure as well as a failure of personnel, both the operator and the controller, to correctly identify and react to this situation. We encourage our passengers to see something, say something. And in this case, they did, and I'm very, very grateful to that. And I apologize that we at Metro did not react appropriately to that information. Another uncommanded door opening occurred aboard a Red Line train recently, Tuesday evening. This instance is still under investigation, and so far there is no commonality with the other two occurrences. From a failure analysis standpoint, these 4K door openings were not related, nor are they relatable to the issues recognized in early 2010. However, we are doing a common investigation of parts review, inspection processes, and life cycle replacement requirements. The entire 4K fleet has been inspected with only two minor defects noted. I have ordered all 4000 series rail cars held out of service, while the car that was involved in the Tuesday evening incident is investigated for the cause of failure. We will also be conducting an independent hazard analysis to confirm our findings. In addition to this work that we're doing investigating the 4K, we have had safety stand-downs in the ROCC and with our train operators to discuss the operator and control response protocols and other potential safe operating issues which may arise. During the period of time while the 4000s are out of service, we will try to maintain the frequency of trains, maintaining the amount of trains that we put out. However, there may be some reduction of trains from 8-car trains to 6-car trains. And I do anticipate some impact of rail service to our customers in terms of passenger crowding. We appreciate their patience as we take this necessary action in the interest of safety. Thank you, and I can take questions on this before I return to the issue with the NTSB.
Okay, thank you very much for your report. Are there any questions from anyone? Tom?
So thanks, Rob, for the report. So when do you estimate that you'll be able to get all these corrections done? I saw a memo, something about midsummer or August.
No, the corrections on the 4000 series car, what we're looking at on the 4000 series car, is we're investigating it. We've gone through the preliminary investigation. We have one item which we're going to take care of over the weekend. Pending the results of that, we anticipate being able to return the cars back to service as early as Tuesday. But again, it's pending the results of that.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Who asked? Oh, Harriet?
Thank you. Just to clarify, the third incident, was that also a 4,000 series car?
That's correct, yes.
Okay, thank you. You said there was no commonality except that it was a
4,000. Except the 4,000, that's correct, yes.
Steve?
Thank you. Can you speak to the 2010 issue that arose with the 4,000 series rail cars? Metro had a similar circumstance and removed all 100 vehicles from service in July of 2010 for circuitry issues with the doors.
Yeah, and that was systemic throughout the cars. What we found is that there was a metal shavings, basically filings, which were creating a conduit, a current path for the bypass circuitry on that. So because that was systemic is why we grounded the entire fleet to be able to take care of that. So the issues here are not systemic. They're not common between the two cars, and they are not the same as that specific thing. Here we actually had the door bypass switch broke, causing the indication to bypass the safety circuitry to be bypassed.
It's my understanding that those repairs occurred over a 2 to 3 week period of time in 2010. So
correct.
You're expecting a much shorter.
Well, again, because this is not systemic, because we can't get there's no commonality in the failures. We don't expect the repairs to be. You know, we're not repairing anything specifically, but we are inspecting all components parts for the cars. So we actually had a campaign in 2010 that we had to go through to repair that specific incident, which we had to take care of.
Further questions, comments? Okay.
Thank you. Now I'd like to turn to the NTSB recommendation, which requires the installation of a ceiling sleeve on our power cable junction points, otherwise known as boot connections and stub-ups. I do have an example of this for the board. This is our boot. This essentially what this does is when we have the power feeds coming from our traction power substations, they go through the conduit, they come to the right-of-way next to the third rail. We use this as a junction point to be able to take that cable and to be able to connect it to our third rail. That is done through the use what is inside here that looks like this. That is done here. And then this is bolted. It's a bolted connection. It looks like this. And then this side of the cable is a little bit more flexible than this side, and this goes to the third rail. This is, again, the power feeder cable, and this is the one that would be stub up like this. What we have is we put on a heat. What we have been doing since about 2011 is putting on a heat shrink sleeve. This gets down, and then this is crimp. This is a compressive crimp that is done in here. We put a heat shrink sleeve on this, which protects water intrusion from the cable, any water intrusion getting into the cable on that point. This is the process that we've been doing for the past 3 years since 2011. The ceiling sleeve is this. This is what the ceiling sleeve is. And this would fit essentially in this right here, and this sleeve would compress down, and it would make a watertight sleeve for that connection. It would make a watertight seal for that connection. This is the piece that the NTSB recognized as not being part of our installation. Okay. So, following the January 12 incident, we investigated cable connection locations, identifying those that were recognized in regards to inspected cable defects, high potential for cable defects, and those that had a high potential for water intrusion. This was necessary to ensure we're not at media risk for a similar situation. And we fully embrace this recommendation by the NTSB and will reply resources as needed to complete the work in a timely manner. We recognize this as being an improvement to our construction methodology and also an important safety initiative. While we have begun immediate work on this recommendation, taking advantage of the existing track outages that we have, we are developing a comprehensive schedule to move forward to include resource loading and also cost estimates. We currently have 270 mainline location groupings exclusive of our rail yard locations. These contain about 6,400 boots within those locations. We anticipate that each location will take approximately 2 days to complete or 540 work days necessary to complete the entire project. This schedule will be optimized for weekday work and application of multiple crews where possible. While full schedule is under development, we will advance the installations on the priority locations immediately. And again, understand that's 540 days of linear work. That's one crew working 540 days. If we get two crews on, obviously it'll be essentially half that time. So as we can resource this thing appropriately, be able to have the time and space which is required to put on, we can shorten the actual duration of being able to make to install this improvement. This recommendation will also improve the safety in that we will conduct a comprehensive interior inspection of the boots to include cleaning and installation of new components where necessary. This work will be scheduled both on the priority locations and also when and where access is available. While we will work during overnight outages, we will also reinstate weekday, midday periods, which will require single tracking and impact train frequency, some of which may result in headways of close to 15 minutes. And again, this is to be able to accelerate the work, take advantage of those midday opportunities where our ridership is a little bit lower, and to be able to get the work done. This is the kind of work that is good in the during the midday period, because we are sure that we can return that to service with minimal risk on that. I will also be coming to the board to discuss methods to do long-term single-track outages of up to 1 week during lower ridership months. Again, I will come to the board with this. We will not institute anything until we talk to the board and obviously inform the public of these to be able to, so they understand what the impacts will be there and the amount of production that we will be able to get. But again, as I've often said, you know, our time and space is a valuable resource to us to be able to move work forward. Again, this will create a greater cost production efficiency, and it'll also be able to do work concurrently, such as insulator replacements during that period of time. Because of our early inspections, we do have a database of all locations, and including photographs, and we will use these for prioritization of the locations. One of the questions that is concerning is, why was this sleeve not consistently installed? The reference drawing is a WMATA design directive drawing, which are typical applications. This type of drawing does allow for design modifications. Prior practice going back 25 years for emergency remediation and state of good repair work was to not install the sleeve. Approximately 3 years ago, a heat shrink was added to remediate against water incoming into the crimp portion of the cable. And this is the heat shrink that I'm talking about. And what happens is heat is applied to this and it compresses down and becomes a watertight seal against that. The issue and concern in this particular case is the potential for inconsistent application represented and allowed by our design directive drawing, and this was recognized by the NTSB. Moving forward, we'll have what is termed a design standard drawing, which does not allow for deviation from the specified drawing. The QC process will be definitive and consistent. Regular QC staff will be assigned to review the work which is being progressed. This is important in installation of this type. Again, I want to say that we are very committed to working closely with the NTSB and implementing as quickly as practical this recommendations and all recommendations that are brought forward. The safety of the 700,000 people who put their trust in our system each day is paramount, and we are committed to that goal. Thank you, and if there are any questions, I certainly would be happy to answer them.
Okay, thank you for your report. Go to questions. The first one I would have is, how much does this cost and how are we going to pay for it?
Again, what we're looking at is we're doing the cost estimates currently. We're putting those forward, and a lot of that will depend on the amount of track time that we can receive and the durations of those track times. So that's what we're looking at to try to get as much efficiency in there, and I should have that schedule done by the end of the month.
A schedule of how much it's going to cost?
Yes, that's correct, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Do you have even a ballpark figure?
I do not at this point, no.
Okay. Okay, questions? Start here. Tony?
Thank you, Mr. Troop. I'm kind of curious, did we bring this to the attention of the NTSB, or did they bring it to our attention?
I believe that the NTSB, I mean, we were certainly open and clear about everything that was going on. We provided all the information to them. I don't remember talking specifically to the NTSB about that. I will find out from other people who have those conversations.
Yeah, I'm just concerned about the capability of our own forces to identify things like this, particularly as it relates to something that may have been put in some time ago. You know, the contract specs, what they called for, things such as that. When we first had the incident of the, well, the original incident that caused this review, we identified 10 or 12 immediate actions that we took. This was not obviously one of them. So I'm a little concerned that we didn't pick that up ourselves early on. So I just want to bring that up to your attention.
Not to speak specifically, obviously, with the NTSB recommendation, you know, I can't because I still am under the federal guidelines. You know, for the early action items, what we wanted to do is be able to do things, get the components up out of the water, mm-hmm. be able to provide those, because this is a, like I said, what happens is we need to go in there, we need to take the do a red tag outage, which means remove the breakers, open the boot up, follow it up, and then you know, take this apart, because what we'll do then is slide. This actually can slide over this and down here. So we need to take this component apart and put it back together. So there's a significant amount of work that that goes on with
it. So at this point, we don't know how many situations exist like this.
We do know how many situations exist like this. Yeah, we anticipate about 80% of our locations.
If I had to put a timeline on it, even though I know you're estimating the cost, what's the range of time we're talking about completing?
I believe, you know, what we are trying to do is we're trying to get to a 14-month process, but it could be, again, depending on track time and our availability of that, you know, 540 days, you know, was that almost 2 years.
And set our priorities on the most vulnerable locations, correct?
This, yeah, we'll take care of those immediately, yes.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Tom?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to get back to a couple things. So this is because water gets into this particular piece of equipment. So you said that you had photographed, inventoried, and so are we going to start with the water intrusion places first?
Yeah, and let me be very clear. What we have done is to, where we have issues with water intrusion, we have uprighted, made sure that those are uprighted, that they're not laying down in the water. So all that has been done. So we've identified those locations. But where we feel the locations are most vulnerable is where we're going.
I'd be interested, Rob, with just, you know, when you get the inventory prioritized, I think the board would like to know what the first tranche is going to be. And the second thing I wanted to ask you is, who makes this piece of equipment, and why don't they have that on this particular piece of equipment?
Again, this was part of our design directive drawing, that these can be provided. A number of manufacturers make this. Generally, we use Mac products, which you know, can provide these sleeves should we ask them to.
So will it, in the future, as these things wear out, are we going to ask the manufacturer to spec up all this water?
What we will make is a design standard drawing. So that will become a design standard for us, and there's no deviation allowed from that.
So when we go out for bids to ultimately replace these, what do you call them, the arcs, mm-hmm. the arcers?
The boots.
That'll have.
And for example, the Largo extension has these sleeves applied to, and the end line, the silver line has these sleeves, these watertight seals on them as well.
Good to know. Thank you,
Harriet.
Thank you for your report, Mr. Troop. So we have an old system, and things tend to go wrong. And I think the thing that might have been most disturbing to people was that we had identified what the problem was likely to be. It was the water intrusion on the electrical components, and that we began to fix it, but we maybe didn't check our own design directive to make sure that we were fixing it properly. So it seems like it might be a really good step in the future when we find a new problem, that we also have a way of making sure that we're fixing it properly, and if we have to tighten up that design directive, and if we have to do some special training so people know all the components that have to happen, that's probably a step worth doing. Is that a change that we could make in our procedures?
It's actually a change that we currently do. We go through and review our engineering drawings on a consistent basis on that. And what I will say again is, while specifically we did not address this in the early action items, the early actions items that I needed to address were those that we could implement very quickly on those. to be able to do those. We recognize that we were going to get other NTSB recommendations. And one thing is we don't want to get too far ahead of what those are. The NTSB, should they find something, they give it to us right away on these. So should they ask us to have a totally new boot or new locking mechanism or something like that, sometimes we don't want to get too far ahead of those. And again, without speaking specifically to the investigation, recognizing this is a public forum on that. So, you know, we are first and foremost, we wanted to get them. We recognized water was the issue. We needed to get them out of the water. We opened up the boots. We cleaned them up. We put the heat shrinks on, which does provide water remediation on these.
We had actually a technical disagreement or question about whether or not the sleeve was necessary.
I don't want to deny that statement or say that it's true. I just cannot go into details in regards to the NTSB investigation at that time until they come out with what a primary root cause is.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you,
Mike.
Robert, just putting together a couple answers to questions, you indicated that we're going to have to do the sleeves on 80% of the system. So the 20% that now has the sleeves are, as you've referenced, the Silver Line and the Largo extension.
And some other locations, correct, yes.
And on those sections that have the sleeve, is it the sleeve that you just showed us that's recommended by the NTSB now?
Yes.
Okay. And you indicated that the reason we have this problem is because we have two sets of design standards, some that are standards which are requirements and some that are called directives, which are recommendations. The sleeves were not covered in what was required. Was the sleeve covered or treated in the directives that are recommendations?
Yes, it was.
And so a contractor reading the directive could have installed the sleeve that the NTSB has now recommended.
Yes, and as for example, you know, on the Silver Line, it was installed.
Okay, and what other accommodation could he have done? What was it? What were his other choices? Did he have to do something, or could he have ignored?
The contractor would have had to say, "I'm going to do this." There could have been tape that they could have put on, you know, like a rubber tape that they could have put down there. They could have put a heat shrink around here to hear different things like that. So there are opportunities. Basically, design directive drawings are presented where we recognize that field conditions may prevail. So that there may be some latitude to be able to identify field conditions. Design standards are saying that, you know, if there's a field condition, the field condition needs to change, not the design standard.
But he would have to do something to address the perceived potential problem of dirt infusions and arcing.
Correct.
Now, just a broader question, a philosophical question. Why do we have two sets of standards? Why do we have things that are required, and why do we have standards that are recommended?
Again, because, you know, we enter into certain design build contracts, we want the contractor the opportunity to bring their expertise in far as construction methodology to be able to do that. And additionally, also, like I said previously, where we have we recognize field conditions, certain field conditions may prevail on items that where we can have certain deviations allowed on those.
And is that fairly standard in the transit industry, that you have these two sets of design standards?
Yes. Yeah, there are. Yes.
You would see that in any system that one
right.
would look at.
Yeah.
As a result of this problem with the sleeves, are there other things that you're looking at that are in the recommended directives that are you're considering whether they should be moved to become required standards?
We go through, there's an engineering process for the specifications that done on a consistent basis, and they do look at all these types of issues. And a lot deals with, you know, previous experience. Have we experienced something, you know, within the previous time frame? Are we looking at these different types of things to be able to move them into a standard specification, say that we need to have it like this?
So is that an ongoing process, or that's
an ongoing
something,
process?
Okay, so
yes.
We're not taking a separate look at it now because of the issue that the NTSB
at this point. I don't see a reason to take a separate look at it.
Okay. Thank you,
Mark.
Bill, go ahead.
Well, yes. Just for clarification again,
The in STB, NTSB, gave us notice that we needed to correct this situation and install the sleeves. And when was that?
Monday.
Just recently?
Just recently, yeah, just recently, yeah.
Oh, I thought they had given indication that...
This week.
All right, okay. So, all right. I'll pass
it. And I just, if I could, one thing, we do have 700 of these kits available to us, which is why we can begin work immediately on this.
Just following up on the NTSB, and I think it was Monday we actually got this. We were given a heads up on Friday that it was coming. This is a good indication of the depth to which the NTSB digs in as they're dealing with this kind of an issue. As I understand, their recommendation report is actually worth reading as to how they go about it. They couldn't tell from the L'Enfant wreckage what had happened, but when a similar incident occurred, they were able to identify this and come back with, here's what we think, not necessarily the cause in L'Enfant, but a safety issue that they've arisen. They will be holding a hearing next week. There will be no surprises at the hearing, but there will be a lot of discussion. But their work will go on. Their recommendations will come much later in the year, and they may find other things. That's their job, is to keep looking in depth. And it's not just water. They have a wonderful paragraph here of all of the contaminants that can be floating around in the tunnel, including something called rail grinding swarf, a word which I'd never heard of before, but that's their job, and I think they're doing a great job, and they have been extremely cooperative in letting us know what's going on and helping us get to the point where we need to be.
Okay, anything further? You know, Bill, I had the same impression you did. So I read that somewhere, that they had told us about this a long time ago, and we didn't fix it, yeah. So who wrote that they said we knew this? Who wrote that? Anybody in this room like that? I want to correct the record that we just found out about this and addressed it, not that we knew about it and we did nothing about it. So whoever wrote that got it wrong. Okay. Anything further? Okay. Thank you very much. Now we're on to the next item, which is the paper fare card elimination.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
You get that a lot.
You get that a lot.
PC Council gets that.
You get that a lot. So that's why I ask people to raise their hands who wrote it and take responsibility. Now I'll go find it.
I thought I read that before, too.
It was in the paper. I'm going to go find it, and then I'm going to call it the reporter.
Buongiorno. My name is Jim Bongiorno, and I'm running the paper fare card elimination project for Womack.
Bongiorno to you, Jim.
And my name is Jim Wynn. I'm the director of the Office of Equal Opportunity.
And we are here today to seek the committee's approval for the Title VI equity analysis and public involvement staff report for the project. Next slide, please. We would you mind punching up the entire timeline, please? Thank you. The board, since 2009, has been on track to eliminate paper from our system. So this is basically the culmination of an effort that has spanned several years. The project is doing well. In fact, we expect our first retrofit kit next month, and we'll be testing that in a lab environment in August. We will pilot it in September, and we start rolling out the retrofit in October, assuming the board approves the Title VI analysis. Next slide, please.
Yes, as Jim stated, this is not just starting. It goes back to 2009, and we are now at a point where 90% of our ridership uses SmartTrip. The remaining 10%, tourists, few weekday riders, and some weekend riders. But we should note that they, too, will benefit from this because no longer will they have to pay that $1 paper surcharge anymore. As staff utilize the approved, board-approved, disparate impact and disproportionate burden threshold, we analyze the proposal to eliminate the paper fare card meter and concluded that there is no Title VI disparate impact on minorities or disproportionate burden on low-income riders. In fact, in this case, the difference between the average fare paid by minority riders and non-minority riders and low-income and non-low-income riders is less than 5%.
Next slide, please. Our public participation effort revealed that the social service agencies had some concerns about the elimination of paper fare cards because they use it as a tool with their clients to help them get from point A to point B. But we do have solutions for them. One of which is for those that have high sales volume, we could install what we refer to as a compact point of sale device at their location. This is, it would be the same device that the CVS and Giants use to sell Smart Trip cards. So that would be a vehicle we could use. The other possibility is we could use Smart Benefits, which is intended for employers but could be used in this case for a social service agency to add value to their client's Smart Trip card. This actually creates an opportunity for the social service agencies to save money, because in today's world, if you think about it, if you're helping out your client, they're going to get a round trip, which means that there will be a $1 per trip surcharge that they have to cover $2 for the round trip. To the extent that they're using what we refer to as a CPAS or a Smart Benefits, that agency will no longer have to pay that $2 round trip charge. They can just add the value of the trip, the actual fare, to this client's Smart Trip card, and that will save that agency money in the long run. If for some reason that's not possible, the client doesn't bring their Smart Trip card back, worst case scenario, they broke even, it's $2 for Smart Trip cards, $2 for the round trip, everybody's good.
Yeah, in fact, on June 26th, members from my staff and from budget will be meeting with one of our largest community-based organizations. They serve 2,000 to 3,000 immigrant students per year here in the district, and they are very interested in options that they can utilize for their students.
Then referring to the timeline, again, I mentioned that we'll be receiving our first retrofit kit next month and for testing in August and September. If the testing goes well, the plan is to start rolling out in October of next year. So we'll go station by station, mezzanine by mezzanine. And as we do that, as we retrofit, what are the, if you will, in your mind's eye, imagine the blue machines in the stations. Those are the ones that we'll be retrofitting. The brown cash machines, we'll just pull the paper out of those. Those will be used to add value to a Smart Trip card only at that point. But that mezzanine then would be selling just Smart Trip cards from that point forward. That'll be about a four-month effort. We'll wrap up in January of 2016, and then with that, that will end all sales of paper fare cards. We'll only be selling Smart Trip cards. That's the end of the first step. The next step is we discontinue taking paper fare cards at the fare gates. We're planning on doing that early March. And then after that, the last step will be we'll discontinue taking fare cards as trade-ins to add value to your Smart Trip card. So the last day for that will be June 30th of 2016. So for all intents and purposes, come July 1st of 2016, if you still have a paper fare card, congratulations, you have a Metro souvenir. Any questions?
Okay, thank you very much. I actually have two questions. If I have my paper fare cards, can I trade them in for cash?
No, you can trade it in to add value to your Smart Trip card.
Okay, so I can't get cash for my paper. Even today I can't get cash, and later on I can't get cash. I can never get cash.
The only way Metro will provide you cash is if you live outside 100 miles outside of the D.C. region.
Oh, really?
Yes, and in that case, you can get a cash refund.
Okay. Now, what if I break my card?
Your paper fare card or your Smart Trip card?
My Smart Trip card.
We have a process online that you can go through to get a replacement, or you can go to a Metro sales office and get a replacement. If you damage the card, we will charge you for a new card. If there's no evidence of damage, then we will provide you a new card at no charge.
Okay, so if it's in my wallet and it breaks in half and I bring it in, you'll give me a new card?
For $2, yes, sir.
Oh, for $2. So I can't get a free one. Oh, I broke it. Oh, God. It's outrageous. So
and our CFO would have it no other way.
All right. Any questions? Yes.
You said in terms of what you're going to do with the agencies, is you said the agencies that have a lot of use a lot of...
Paper fare sales?
What about a smaller agency that uses paper fare cards now? They wouldn't have enough volume for point of sale. What would you plan on doing with them?
That's where we would leverage our smart benefits program for them. So they could then, we can set them up as if they were an employer, and then we can register their client cards can be registered to the program, and they can then electronically allocate funds, and we bill them for the funds that they do provide to their clients.
But then their client would have to go and touch their card to
a target, a smart target, to an ad fair
in order to get their additional benefits.
That's correct. By the way, they'd have to tap their card to enter the system or ride the bus, so it works out. There should be no additional difficulty in doing that.
The second question is that it looks like the stations that make the most use of paper fare cards are the stations that basically tourists go to.
Absolutely.
One of the things that was apparently fairly popular before is we were selling smart trips with pictures of baby zoo animals on them.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have some special kind of tourist? In other words, if people get stuck with a smart trip card that they use for a couple of days and then it becomes, as you said, a souvenir, are we going to make something very souvenir-y looking that they might actually not be upset about?
I have to answer no to that question as far as the smart trip cards being dispensed from what are currently our blue passes and fare card machines, because those cards will be set up differently than the cards that are being dispensed from our current smart trip card dispensers, the kiosks. The part of the reason for that is, and this is what's really going to help the tourists or the visitors, is that unlike the current smart trip card dispensers where you put $10 in and you get a card out, it's $8 in value on the card, $2 for the card itself, $10 total, that's your only option right now. Once we have retrofitted one of the blue machines, you'll be able to add any value you want to that card. You'll be able to add rail passes to that card that you can't do today. So that'll give the tourists a lot more flexibility, but that requires that we use a standardized graphic on the front of that card at this stage of the game because of the quantity that we have to purchase them in.
If I may add, some of the popular cards, as Ms. Porter points out, have been those that have been specially branded the Smart Trip plastic cards. And so whether it's been the Van Gogh art exhibit or more zoo babies or President Obama's inaugural commemorative card, those are equally as popular, and we've been able to sell out of those very quickly as the original Panda branded paper card. And so those have proven very popular with our riders, both everyday commuters as well as visitors. And in fact, the Smart Trip card averages about 4.5 years in somebody's wallet. When they see those new souvenir or special edition or special event cards, often they buy them and trade out what they've been carrying in their wallet. That's been our experience.
But we can't sell those through the dispensers.
We could sell them through the existing Smart Trip card dispensers where you're paying $10, and we can certainly sell them through other outlets. We can do that.
During the trade-in period, March through June, all these people now have stacks of paper fare cards in their bottom drawers. Will they be able to make that trade at the station?
Yes.
So it's not come down to Jackson Graham Building to turn these in.
They don't have to. In fact, that's an excellent point, and that's going to be part of our public outreach, which will be starting following the board's approval of the Title VI and the public participation plan, to emphasize, don't wait, start trading them in now, and you can trade them in at any of our current ticket vending machines presently. Right.
Thank you.
For my colleagues, thank you. We've got this huge contract with Accenture for an open fare policy for the future.
Yes, sir.
Just so many of my colleagues don't know about that, they're in a pilot program. A couple questions. How does this slide into our Accenture future for open fare collection?
Well, to support that future, we have to eliminate the paper fare cards. If you've noticed the pilot gates in the stations for the NEPT program do not have paper fare card slots in them, so we have to get rid of the paper. This is actually helping that project in terms of moving things along.
Okay, so this is our second following question. So are we up to, like, this is a tough question. Do we have to pay Cubic to make this shift, or are we putting this into the Accenture contract?
The board approved paying Cubic last May, a year ago May.
I don't remember that at all. Can you refresh our memory about how we got hoodwinked by Cubic again?
I don't know if I would characterize it that way, but...
Well, everything you do with Cubic, there's a price.
Of course. They are, in fact, did the engineering to develop the transport mechanism. Mm-hmm. So essentially what will be happening is you open the machine, you pull out the paper transport mechanism,
yeah.
You put in the smart trip transport mechanism, and the code that goes along with that, right. And you're on your way.
Okay.
And that required a payment to Cubic to make that happen, yes, sir.
All right. So, but when we go to the Accenture future, we're not going to be having to, every time we want to do something minor or modest, have to go back to Cubic to get...
The Accenture system is independent of
right,
Cubic system.
Right. I understand it. Okay. So finally, I just want to point out that we did something here at the board not too long ago with the Destination DC, where we have a arrangement to provide smart cards to tourists and conventioneers and so forth. Is that an aspect of this initiative?
I'm not as familiar with that particular program, but if it's using smart trip cards, it'll work just fine. Right.
And it so should.
It will work. Yeah. That doesn't change. We'll set them at the targets. But I'm not aware that we won't be doing these machines will work. Essentially, the blue machine is going to work just like it does today, except that instead of getting a piece of paper, you're going to get a smart trip card. If you're buying the smart trip card for the very first time, we'll charge you $2 for it. That's one difference. The other difference is as we retrofit the machine, you won't be able to trade in paper because we have to take out that mechanism, but you can still use the brown machines to trade in paper. And then the third difference and the biggest benefit for the visitors is that you can also add passes to the card in addition to any value you'd like up to $300.
Jim?
Yes.
Jim. So let me ask, what is your largest personal concern and the organization's largest concern with this transfer?
The thing that the biggest concern I would have is that we don't know precisely what the ratio is between how many smart trip cards we're going to sell in lieu of paper fare cards. So in other words, the analysis that we've done suggests that in today's world, about 40% of our paper fare card sales are one-way trips, and that the rest are multiple trip sales. So we're basing our card orders to stock the machines on that analysis. But we don't have actual experience around that at this stage of the game in terms of what the actual sales will be. So we are, we're already inventorying cards and working with the card manufacturer to make sure that we'll have a steady supply just in case our estimate is a little bit off. We've also worked closely with our revenue collection folks in terms of a plan around how we're going to stock the machines. And in fact, that's why I mentioned the cards are slightly different. The cards that we will be using in these machines have no street value. So if I were to lose a box of 500 cards, it's just 500 pieces of plastic. You couldn't even add value to those cards. That means that we can use even a maintenance technician to stock the machines if we needed to keep up with demand around, say, cherry blossom season, 4th of July, and so forth. In fact, we designed the transport to have a box of cards in the hole, so to speak, so that we could do just that in a pinch if we had to. And, in fact, that's why we're planning on leaving these smart trip card dispensers out there also to provide additional capacity in the event that we need it. But that would be the one thing, and we do have a plan in place to address it.
So you do have a safety stock. We're not going to run out of cards.
We have a safety stock. I talked to Mr. Leslie, who is in charge of ordering that on a regular basis. So we're keeping an eye on that. We should be good to go.
All right. Thank you.
Further? All right. One last question on the retrofitting the machines. Mm-hmm. So we're doing 450, you say?
Yes.
Okay. Is that enough or too many? Or
that's all we have.
That's all we have. We're doing all of them. Okay. And all right. So anything else we need to know?
I don't think so.
Okay, very good. So this is an action item that we, oh, I'm sorry.
I just have one question. One question. Everyone I know has a fan of paper cards that have been faulty or that didn't have enough value, and they have a stack of them. Mm-hmm. Everybody has a stack of them. So I'm just a little worried about how fast the time frame is from when we're not going to take them. Like, you know, less than a year from, a year from now, right?
It's a year from now, yes.
That those will be utterly without any value, and I'm just worried that people won't get the chance to redeem them or send them in or do whatever they need to do to get credit for them. Are we confident that that's going to, you know, we're going to be able to reach everybody to let them know that they need to do this? I mean, in some cases, they might have considerable value on those paper cards.
I'm confident that with the help of our external relations and marketing team that we will get the message out to everyone. And as you've mentioned, you'll have over a year from today to start trading in those cards, and you can do that at any currently at any ticket vending machine. You can walk up. In fact, I would recommend using the brown machines. The lines are shorter there because they take cash only, and it's a simpler process. And we will be producing literature that talks about the very simple process that you go through to churn in the paper fare card and add the value to your smart trip card.
But so like Mr. Ventura, I mean, maybe it's just me, but mine get demagnetized and don't work anymore. My stack at home are not those. My stack are those that I have to mail into WMATA, and it takes months to get back. Well, for me, anyway, it's taken months, and sometimes I have to call again to get it to see what's happened to them. Or at least once, I never heard anything again. But so I would just say it's not just using the brown machine. It sometimes might be more involved transactions with WMATA.
Yes, and we will have instructions if you have a significant number of cards. In fact, we're already reaching out to social service agencies and other agencies that have significant inventories of cards to work with them directly through our Stern Media Services team to convert those into value. So we are very sensitive to that point, and we will certainly pull out the stops to make sure that everyone is aware, they have plenty of notice, and that we give them various opportunities or avenues to turn in their cards.
Yeah, working with external affairs, it would be nice to have a little brochure in the stations that says, here's what you need to do.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Okay, anything further? All right, so I would move the approval of the Title VI Equity Analysis and Elimination of Paper Fare Cards on Metro Rail Resolution. Is there a second?
Second.
Any further discussion? Okay, seeing none, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Okay. All right, our next item before us is the to amend the FY 2016 to 21 CIP. Who's here to talk about that?
Chairman, yep. Let me start again. Yep. As you know, we received, we had inquired of the FTA the ability for us to replace rather than provide a midlife overhaul for our 5,000 series car. We provided them with substantial reporting documents to produce our case. We were very fortunate to receive concurrence from the FTA with the conditions that we'd be able to, that they would support our replacement of the 5,000 series cars, which leads to the next step that we have the option to, for 220 cars, to expand the 7,000 series fleet. The action today is to replace the funding in the CIP from 2016 to 2021. Funding for the payments for the rail cars and also for the power upgrades required to operate the expanded fleet of 7,000 series and 8-car trains. We see this as a great opportunity to get the 5,000 series cars out of the system earlier than if there was a midlife overhaul. It will increase reliability and will actually increase the amount of service that we'll be able to provide to our customers. The resolution also suggests that once the purchase of 220 cars allows us to replace all 192 cars of the 5,000 series, allows us to have 28 additional cars, which we have enough room on our system to allow for expansion of services on the Red Line, and the desire is to eliminate the Grosvenor turnback, which we've had in existence for years, and we think that we will be able to provide end-of-line service and eliminate that turnback through this process. So we're requesting from the board authorization, or the committee authorization, to move forward with the amendments to the CIP so that we'll be in a situation to where we can exercise the option in July on the 220 additional rail cars from Kawasaki.
Okay, thank you very much. Is there any discussion? Oh, sure, absolutely. So I'd like to move the amendment to the staff proposed language for item 3B.
Yeah, I think
they
have to move the original.
Oh, where's that?
That's the one
that had that. Oh, this one here? Okay. So we'd like to move the amendment to the fiscal year 2016-21 capital improvement program.
Second.
Okay. Discussion.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mike, over there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The draft resolution is one that is excellent. I and Maryland can support it. It does three great things. It provides for the purchase of the 192 new 7,000 rail cars, provides for power upgrades funding on the blue and orange line, and as the interim general manager pointed out, it provides for ending the red line turnbacks at Grosvenor so that those cars will, during rush hour, originate and terminate at Shady Grove. I'd like to propose an amendment, though, to take the resolution and go one step further, if I may. And that is a motion that I've tabled, which would do two things. It would increase our expenditures in the future period, in FY 2021 specifically, by $28 million. Provide for a down payment on power upgrades on the red line, and it would, in the second part of the resolution, provide for a funding source for that addition, and it would come out of planned long-term financing, which would also be increased by $28 million in FY 2021. So we've balanced a funding source of $28 million with the new expenditure of $28 million in FY 2021. So this amendment essentially does two things. It carries us forward and says that as a board, we're not going to stop with our eight-car train project with our power upgrades on the blue and orange line, but we're going to take another step forward after that and begin the process of power upgrades on the red line so that the red line could eventually have eight-car trains as well, and it reinforces this broad commitment to a regional solution that all lines should eventually have power upgrades and the eight-car trains that will be possible when there are the power upgrades. So I commend
okay, is that the amendment? Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, discussion.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I think this is an acceptable amendment here. It's consistent with the 2025 goal, and while we will have our yearly approval of a capital improvement plan as we go forward, it just simply moves us a little bit further out. So I think it's acceptable.
Further?
Question. Mr. Goldman, just as a point of clarification, you had mentioned 192 rail cars. It's really for the full funding of the 220.
Sorry, 220 to replace it. I should have said the 220 new rail cars. To replace the 192.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure there wasn't something in the amendment that was.
No,
thank
sir.
You.
Yeah, I just want to support both the basic motion and Mr. Goldman's amendment. I think, in particular, it's looking forward to a time when the capacity of the system is going to have to be constrained. In a sense, it is saying the momentum plan is still there. It's being deferred. It's being implemented first on blue and orange, where there is immediate problem, but it also needs to be done across the system and probably will require additional cars in the fleet, but that's all for future discussion. But the fact that we have an ongoing process for the whole system and the whole region, I think, is very important.
Okay, further? Okay. All in favor of approval of the
I guess it's the underlying and the amendment, or the amendment first. The amendment, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it. Now, the underlying bill as amended.
Sorry,
not a bill,
one other small amendment.
Oh, you do another one.
This is just a clarifying amendment, and it goes to the resolved paragraph, fourth from last resolved paragraph on the second page of the draft resolution. It's the one that deals with the Grosvenor turnbacks. And this is just a clarifying amendment, and it would just add on the second line after the words Grosvenor turnback the following: such that all rush hour trains originate and terminate at Shady Grove Station, unquote. It's essentially a clarifying amendment so that it's clear what is meant by the end of the Grosvenor turnbacks.
Okay, the amendment before us. Is there a second?
Second.
Second. Any discussion on the amendment? Tom?
Is there an analysis to back this up?
Analysis of?
Of just data. The data that supports not turning back a Grosvenor versus going to Shady Grove.
In the whereas paragraph, there are conclusions that we as a board are making,
okay,
that ending the Grosvenor turnbacks will reduce congestion both on that stretch in Maryland as well as on trains generally, because trains should be more evenly in terms of number of passengers throughout the whole Red Line system.
Okay. Further,
more just with respect to that, once you start running these trains all the way out, this will increase the annual operating costs, but that will be going into the formula.
Okay, now the amendment is before us, right? All right, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it. Now we have the full bill. It's not a bill, what is it?
Resolution.
We have the full resolution as amended before us. Is there any discussion on that? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it. And who said the board doesn't get along?
That's right.
Huh? Who said that? Look at this.
Unanimous.
Huh? Unanimous.
It was just the Finance Committee.
It's just the Finance Committee. All right. But we're working together. Okay. Next item on our agenda is the Financial Status Update and FMO Progress Report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Good afternoon. Our objectives today are to provide you a brief financial update with respect to our grants management status and present the monthly progress status on Metro's committed corrective action plan items in response to the Federal Transit Administration's Financial Management Oversight Review Report. This month's FMO reporting includes progress through the end of May and a little bit of progress in early June. Since May 1st, Metro has reduced its outstanding short-term debt by 40% from $503 million to $302 million. And this is by making $117 million in payments on our grant anticipation notes, which leaves $83 million of the original $200 million remaining outstanding. We also paid down $84 million on our lines of credit, and we have $219 million of lines of credit still outstanding. Our ability to reduce our outstanding short-term debt is due in large part to recent successes with substantial federal grant reimbursements. Our federal grant draws were $52 million in April and $84 million in May, for a total of $136 million in fourth quarter receipts so far. Of that amount, approximately $66 million were reimbursements of labor and fringe benefits costs. Metro's total federal grant draws since the March 2014 ECHO drawdown restriction was imposed is now $287 million. Our total submissions have been $401 million, and we have approximately $114 million. They're currently under review. With respect to the three lines of credit due to expire in the month of June, the almost $89 million line of credit with Bank of America Merrill Lynch is in the final review stages for renewal, hopefully to June 23rd, 2016. Our existing $75 million line of credit with U.S. Bank has been extended for 3 months to through August 31st. And the almost $64 million line of credit with Wells Fargo is in negotiation for an extension of up to 3 months, with full annual renewal dependent upon publication of Metro's fiscal year 2014 audited financial statements. Our summary timeline recaps the key major milestone dates of corrective action plans submitted, follow-up requests received, and follow-up submissions provided, all since the FMO report was issued exactly 1 year ago yesterday. The FMO dashboard composite chart contains the following: completion risk of the 65 cap items by finding level, the status of our FMO-related training in key areas, a chart that illustrates the quality and acceptance level of our drawdown packages submitted, and a summary of the number of FPA recommendations fulfilled based upon our corrective action plan submissions. This month's FMO dashboard has two updates since our last report, to the manual draw submission quality reimbursement success area and the completion of the FPA recommendations. Our CAPS completion status remains unchanged. 62 of the 65 CAPS have been submitted to FDA, and two have been requested to be extended, and one had an original commitment due date of this month. The two extended FMO recommendations under the material weakness finding budget controls that WMATA requested completion due date extensions to June 30th, 2015, were first to complete the reconciliation of all costs charged to the remaining 18 active grants of the original 35 open grants during the FMO review. Secondly, to submit any requests for budget revisions grant amendments that were necessary as a result of the reconciliation. And then lastly, during the reconciliation period, FDA has directed us to ensure that any amounts that were identified as duplicate draws or overdraws be repaid to the FDA immediately. Our manual draw submission package quality metrics track the approval rate of both individual package submissions as well as the total cumulative dollar amounts of manual draw submissions since imposition of the ECHO draw restriction in March of last year. During April and May, the FDA approvals of our submissions averaged 99%, and our cumulative manual reimbursement success rate through May remains at 98%. The FMO compliance training graph reflects the participation in training courses from what we estimated and what we actually trained, but that's been unchanged since through May. Our final dashboard quadrant chart reflects the number of corrective action plans submitted against the 9 material weakness and significant deficiency findings, and the number of FMO report recommendations within those findings that our corrective action plan submissions have been deemed by FDA as having been adequately fulfilled. FMO findings that have been 100% fulfilled are highlighted in green. Now, based on feedback from FDA, our CAP submissions and follow-up responses submitted from last July through May of this year, the total number of adequately fulfilled FMO recommendations now stands at 34.5 out of 38. And the number of findings with completed recommendations is 6 out of 9. Open findings with recommendations still requiring confirmation of corrective action plans are the budget controls and cash and grant management controls, which will be fulfilled by the reconciliation of the grants and by making our caps extended to June 30th, and the financial management system access controls for which we've submitted all the follow-ups, and we've gotten indications that they satisfy the recommendations, and we're just waiting for final FDA confirmation of fulfillment on those, on that one. I'm pleased to report, as far as the activity update, I'm pleased to report that we're on track to complete the budget reconciliations and transmit all associated budget revisions on time by the June 30th deadline. Yesterday, June 10th, marked exactly 1 year since release of the final FMO review report. With the completion of the last of the corrective action plan items by June 30th, we'll have completed submission of all FMO caps, follow-ups, and responses that were due to the FDA. Including extended items, we've met all our due dates, both committed by us and requested by the FDA for submissions throughout the entire FMO response process. Our internal compliance office continues its focus on control certification reviews in the primary material weakness and significant deficiency areas identified in the FMO report. I'd like to close by reviewing our next steps. In the next 2.5 weeks, we will complete the activities for completion of all the committed cap items. We'll continue conducting biweekly status review meetings with the FTA Region 3 staff, which have become highly productive communication sessions for collectively addressing any key issues, open items, and follow-ups in such areas as grant drawdown submissions, grant applications, force account plans, and cost allocation plans, among others. Our internal compliance staff continues to conduct follow-up reviews and control certifications to help ensure sustained compliance with FMO-related corrective actions and further strengthen internal financial management controls. Next month, you'll be getting an update from our Director of Internal Compliance, Liz Sullivan, on our fourth quarter activity. Mr. Chairman, that concludes this month's FMO update report. At this time, I'd be happy to answer any questions from the committee. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much for your report. Questions? Mort?
Yeah, first, I just want to thank all of the finance staff for a year of hard work. It's taken us to get to this point. It's a good point to be at. At the audit committee this morning, we discussed the Inspector General report with respect to jurisdictional contributions. And as my assumption is, now that we have the federal side relatively under control, it will be the building block for dealing with all of the other aspects of the capital program.
That is correct. By completing these reconciliations, we'll be able to then complete the reconciliation of the jurisdictional subsidy amounts.
And your comment that we did not have to do any grant amendments to make this happen tells me there was the right work was in the original grants. The issue was linking the expenditures to those grants.
That's correct.
So we're not leaving any federal money on the table.
No.
Good.
I know that on the Largo grant, we underspent the project, so there's a little bit left on that. But.
I was at a meeting yesterday evening at which some statements were made that I think reflect some public sort of misunderstanding about the agency's financial status, and I wonder if I could ask you to clarify. One of the statements made was that the agency was in default. Is the agency currently in default on any of its loans?
Technically, in some of our agreements, yeah, because we haven't published our financial statements by the dates due with our bondholders and on some of our tax advantage leases, but we have notified them appropriately of all of our condition, and that we expect to, you know, working hard to try and finish the audit financial statements for fiscal year 2014.
But have they attempted to recover any of those funds?
No.
Okay. And the second question is, have we been denied any federal funds? Now, I understand that we have some federal funds outstanding that we haven't heard yet what they're going to do, but have we been actively denied any federal funds?
No, I don't. We haven't been denied. I don't believe, as one of the CAPS recommendations indicated, of course, if we found any incorrectly drawn amounts, you would certainly have to pay them back. We haven't found any duplicate draws. The staff has been very thorough in going back and doing these reconciliations. They, in fact, found an amount of about $330,000 that was drawn against one grant that maybe should have been drawn against another, and paying that back to FDA with other submissions, but that's the only one they found.
Right, and that's basically shifting it from one thing to another thing. But we haven't sort of been denied the funding.
Right.
Jim?
May I ask, what grants are still outstanding as far as a dollar amount that have been applied for, but we have not been, this has not been repaid for?
So, thank you so much, Mr. Cochran, for that question. Perhaps I can start with respect to the FY16 CIP that the board just approved. As you recall, the directive to staff is that we need to apply for those grants within 4 weeks of board approval. I would like to report to this board that as of yesterday, we've applied for 3 of 4 grants. And the expectation is that by tomorrow, certainly by Monday, we would have applied for all of the grants that are contained within the FY16 CIP. That said, about a year ago, we had approximately $500 million of unreimbursed federal expenses. And recognizing that this is a dynamic process, I mean, those meaning that on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, we continue to be engaged in capital projects, and those capital projects result in expenses, which ultimately should turn into reimbursements. So there are reimbursements, as Blair reported, that are coming in, but also there's additional costs that are going in. I think the process that we've engaged in, which is the aggressive review of those invoices, the significant conversations and support of the FTA, has resulted in approximately $200 million of reduction from that $500 million. And obviously, the continuing conversation is focused on recovering all of those funds. As we sit here today, there's about $50 million of expenses that we've working with FTA to seek their approval on. So this is a continuing process, and we are grateful to the FTA for the amount of resources that they've dedicated to this exercise and the amount of time that the folks in finance and operations and across this organization are putting in to review the invoices to make sure that they're accurate, which is consistent with what Blair reported earlier in terms of the approval rates. And so we expect that as an organization, we will be recovering most of the funds that are still outstanding, but ultimately they will take time as we get to smaller values contained in those recoveries, but it's an exercise that we are all engaged in on a daily basis.
All right, so to clarify, we have received payment of approximately $200 million for of $500 that we had fallen behind on requesting the reimbursements for.
Right.
There's another $50 million currently under review at FTA that we are awaiting reimbursement. So there's $250 million out there that we've not yet requested reimbursement, or is there $250 out there that's under review in addition?
That's correct. There's the $250 that's still out there, obviously, is the result of several factors, part of which obviously deal with prior legacy timekeeping issues that need to be resolved, but some of it obviously deal with our own internal pipeline for reviewing those contracts, mm-hmm. and for making sure we have the right documentation in order to ultimately get FTA's approval. The process here is much more robust than it was before, and our ultimate goal is to get back to ECO, direct ECO draws.
Right.
And as we, I believe, as we continue to demonstrate our fidelity to the process and our accuracy with respect to the results, then when FTA comes back to review our processes, we expect that they will make the right decision with respect to restoration of the ECO privilege to Metro.
Okay, thank you.
Further?
Just further comment. And it relates to working down this problem, but assuring we don't have it in the future. I have asked staff in the near term, probably next month, to lay out a work program to get us off to the best possible start on our next six-year plan. How will it be managed? How will it be funded? We have about a year to work through that before we come into the period when the present capital funding agreement expires, and I hope to see from Jack a robust program of all the things we need to do to be sure we can build off the progress that's been made and not in any way slip back to where we were before.
Okay, I have a question and a comment. When you submit the grant reconciliations, what are the next steps to draw down the remaining balances and close the old grants?
Reconciliations of the grants is effectively saying what we have spent by line item on each grant and demonstrating that to FTA. In order to receive reimbursement for those expenses that we have not yet received reimbursement for, the process that Dennis just described, assembling the documentation, ensuring that it's complete and accurate and reviewable by FTA, working through each one of those expenses that's incurred and charged to a grant. So it's the same process. Effectively, when you complete a reconciliation of a grant and the expenses charged to that grant, you have the universe of everything that needs to be reimbursed identified, and then it's a matter of working through that documentation.
Okay. And then the request, I think, Jack, I had made that a little bit earlier, is to get a cash flow analysis. And maybe we have that now for us.
We have that, and we're going to provide it to the board in the mail out tomorrow.
Okay. Okay. So it goes out about 18 months, is that it, or how?
Through fiscal year 16, yes.
Through fiscal year 16. Yeah. So a cash flow analysis.
We just got that finished, and we're going to get that out.
Okay. So all the board members will have a sense of where we are, with cash coming in, and all that kind of stuff. Okay? Okay, good. Anything further? Okay, thank you very much for your presentation. Okay, as far as I can tell, I don't have anything else on the agenda. Is that right? Anything else on the agenda? Does anybody else want to raise anything that's not on the agenda?
No.
Don't do that. Don't even ask that. Okay, seeing there's nothing else to talk about, the meeting's adjourned. Thank you.